The give and take of domestic harmony. Socrates, the great Greek philosopher from Athens, told his students, by all means, marry. If you get a good wife, twice blessed you will be. If you get a bad wife, you'll become a philosopher. Well, I am twice blessed. When Eric called Diana and me for our first session of marriage counseling, we kiddingly said, well, we have 105 years of experience between us. What would you like to know? Listen to Chuck Swindoll's testimony. 7 days after our first date, I was convinced Cynthia was the girl of my dreams, so I asked her to marry me. Though only 16 and still in the 11th grade, Cynthia said yes. A little over 18 months later, on June 18, 1955, we said, I do. At just 18 and barely 20, we began our journey together that is now in its seventh decade. Looking back, Cynthia and I often sigh and sometimes smile. Contrary to public opinion, we haven't been sheltered from life's harsh words and winds. To make matters even more challenging, neither of us have been particularly easy to live with. Our marriage garden has spanned the extremes from surviving to thriving, but we've made it for two reasons: God's unfaltering grace and our uncompromising commitment. Keeping a marriage together is hard work. Making it thrive is even harder. But thankfully, God has filled His Word with principles that benefit and breathe life into our unions. Cynthia and I have taken the time to follow these principles, and we've applied them as often as possible. Well, a wedding is one thing, and a marriage is quite another. What a difference between the way things start in a home and the way they continue. In his delightful little book, Secrets to Inner Beauty, Joe Aldrich humorously describes the realities of married life. It doesn't take long for the newlyweds to discover that everything in one person nobody gets. They soon learn that marriage is simply a marriage license, is just a learner's permit. And they ask with agony, is there life after marriage? Marriage has become and begins like a romantic moonlight sleigh ride, smoothly gliding over the glistening snow. It's living together when the honeymoon is over that turns out to be rough backpacking over rocks and hot sand. And for two people to live in domestic harmony, it takes a lot of give and take. If you need any confirmation of this, just look outside your own life. Just look at the statistics. Oh, no, forget statistics. Just look about you, on your job, in your office, around your neighborhood, even at church. Broken marriages, separations, divorces, fractured homes. Some children have so many step-parents they can hardly keep track of them. When our son Chips was in an independent high school in Raleigh, I prepared an invitation for the Ravenscroft parents, 300 children, for a special event. For the 300 students, it took over 500 invitations to address all the different moms and dads. In an essay on a theme of arranged marriages, writer Philip Yancey offers these insights. In the U.S. and other Western-style cultures, people tend to marry because they are attracted to one another's appealing qualities. A fresh smile, a pleasing figure, athletic ability, a cheerful disposition, charm. And over time, these qualities can change, and the physical attributes especially will deteriorate with age. Meanwhile, surprises may surface. Slatternly housekeeping, a tendency toward depression, disagreements over sex. And in contrast, the parents in an arranged marriage, and over half of all marriages in our international global villages fit this description, but they do not center the relationship on mutual attractions. Having heard your parents' decision, you accept that you will live for many years with someone you now barely know. And thus the overriding question becomes not whom shall I marry, but given this partner, what kind of marriage can we construct together? And truthfully, this is the kind of attitude we need if we're going to move beyond romance into reality to build a strong and lasting life together. Well, the Apostle Peter gives us some very helpful advice here in the third chapter of 1 Peter. Tucked away in the heart of this letter is this little gem of truth, like a diamond in a ring. And without the right setting to enhance its beauty, this little gem would simply get lost. But viewed in the proper settings, it becomes a little sparkling delight. And in the Bible, this setting is called scriptural context. And the key term in this context is the word submit. It's translated from a Greek military term, meaning to fall in rank under the authority of another, to subject oneself for the purpose of obeying or pleasing another. The first six verses of this little gem of truth refer to wives, and the seventh single verse refers to husbands. One New Testament scholar gives the following explanation for this seeming inequity. It may seem strange that Peter's advice to wives is six times longer than it is for a husband. If a husband became a Christian, he would automatically bring his wife with him into the church. But if his wife became a Christian while her husband did not, she was taking a step which was unprecedented and which produced the acutest problems. Well, despite that explanation, this passage is probably one of the hot potatoes in Scripture, especially for women. But let me put you at ease. I don't believe that this or any other part of Scripture admonishes a wife to stay in a situation where her health is being threatened, where her life or the lives of her children is in danger. That's not what submission is about. In these first six verses of chapter 3, there are at least three implied imperatives woven into the fabric of these verses. They are reasonable and doable commands. They are not culturally irrelevant. Best of all, they work. Let's listen. I'm reading from the New Living Translation. In the same way, you wives must accept the authority of your husbands, and then even if some refuse to obey the good news, your godly lives will speak to them without any words. They will be won over by observing your pure and reverent lives. Don't be concerned about the outward beauty of fancy hairstyles, expensive jewelry, or beautiful clothes. You should clothe yourselves instead with the beauty that comes from within, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is so precious to God. This is how the holy women of old made themselves beautiful. They put their trust in God and accepted the authority of their husbands. For instance, Sarah obeyed her husband Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters when you do what is right without fear of what your husband might do. That phrase, in the same way or in the like manner, refers us back to Peter's discussion of the example of Jesus Christ in 1 Peter 2, verses 21 through 25. Just as Jesus was submissive and obedient to God's will, so a Christian husband and wife should follow Christ's example. Much of our learning in life does come from imitation. Grandparents have a delightful time watching their children pick up new skills and words as they grow up. And if we imitate the best models, we'll become better people and better achievers. But if we imitate the wrong models, it will cripple our lives and possibly ruin our characters. The role models that we follow influence us in every stage of life. I like what Mark Anderson says about we have lots of people upstream from us that we can learn from. Peter points to Sarah as a model for Christian wives to follow. To be sure, Sarah wasn't perfect, but she proved to be a good helpmate to Abraham. And she's one of the few women who are named in the faith chapter in Hebrews 11. Chuck Swindoll, many wives tend to view their roles as conditional. Their behavior depends upon the behavior of their husbands. Sure, I'll be the kind of wife I should be if he's the kind of husband he should be. On the surface, that may seem and sound great. Turnabout is fair play. But there's only one problem. This passage is not written just to wives who have husbands who play fair. Peter doesn't let us off the hook that easily. The passage is written to all wives, especially those whose husbands are disobedient to the word. In fact, by implication, this paragraph is directed to women who live with disobedient husbands, husbands who are going their own way, husbands who don't respect the things of God and even mock them. In short, these are husbands who are not measuring up to God's standards. Crotchety husbands set in their ways, or ornery wives unwilling to budge, can be real obstacles to the application of these principles found in 1 Peter 3. So, Peter gives us reasons, at least three, as to why a Christian wife should submit to her husband, even if the husband, as in this case, isn't saved. Submission, first, is an obligation. God has commanded this because in his wisdom, he knows that this is the best arrangement for a happy, fulfilling marriage. Subjection does not mean that the wife is in any way inferior to her husband. In fact, in 1 Peter 3:7, Peter makes it clear that the husband and the wife are heirs together. The man and woman are made by the same Creator out of the same basic material. Both are made in God's image. God gave dominion to both Adam and Eve in Genesis 1:28. And in Jesus Christ, Christian mates are one, Galatians 3:28. Submission has to do with order and authority, not evaluation. For example, the slaves in the average Roman household were in many times far superior to their masters, but they still had to be under authority. When I was a buck private in the U.S. Army at training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, I must admit I felt I was a better person than the foul-mouthed master sergeant I was under. But he was the master sergeant. Even Christ himself became a servant, submitted to God's will. And there's nothing degrading about submitting to authority or accepting God's order. If anything, it's the first step toward fulfillment. Ephesians 5:21 makes it clear that both husband and wife must first be submitted to Jesus Christ. Husbands and wives must be partners, not competitors. After one wedding ceremony that I performed with one particular couple, I said, "Now remember, from now on, it's no longer mine and yours. It is ours." In Peter's counsel, secondly, submission is also an opportunity to win an unsaved husband to Christ. God not only commands submission, but he also uses it as a powerful spiritual influence. One of the greatest examples of a godly wife and mother in church history is Monica, the mother of the famed Saint Augustine. God used Monica's witness and prayers to win both her son and her husband to Christ, though her husband was not converted until just shortly before her death. And in writing his confessions, Augustine says, "She served him as her Lord and did her diligence to win him unto thee, preaching thee unto him by her conversation and behavior, by which thou ornamentest her, making her reverently amiable unto her husband." Peter simply says, Sarah obeyed Abraham. And one paraphrase says, she paid attention to him. You see, a wife isn't responsible for her husband's life. She's responsible for her life. And you can't make your husband as something that he is not. Only God can do that. Ruth Graham once said, "It's my job to love Billy. It's his job to make him good." That's a pretty good philosophy for any wife to embrace. Dear wives, it's your job to love your husband, and it's God's job to change his life. I also like what James Dobson says, "Committed love yields the highest return on investment at maturity." In a Christian home, we must love and minister to each other. A Christian husband must minister to his wife and help beautify her in the Lord. Ephesians 5, 25 to 30. A Christian's wife must encourage her husband, help him grow strong in the Lord. Parents and children must share burdens and blessings to seek and to maintain a spiritual excitement and growth in the home. And third, submission is an ornament. The word translated adorning is cosmos in the Greek. We get our English words cosmos, the ordered universe, and also cosmetic is the opposite of chaos. Peter warned that the Christian wife was not to major on external decorations, but rather on internal character. In fact, the Roman women were captivated by the latest fashions of the day. They competed with each other in dress and hairdos. It wasn't unusual for the women to have elaborate coiffures and studded with gold and silver combs and even jewels. They wore elaborate, expensive garments, all for the purpose of impressing each other. But obviously, Peter here he's having a sharp contrast between inner beauty and outer beauty. As Peter puts it, between outer adornment and inner adornment. It's just so easy in our shop to you drop culture that to get carried away with the externals. Catalogs for every conceivable kind of clothing come into our mailbox. And with their 800 numbers and websites that are ready to take your order 24 hours a day, ready, set, charge. The point of the contrast here is to restore the balance. Peter isn't prohibiting the braiding of hair or the wearing of jewelry or the wearing of fine clothes. He merely wants those things to be put in the background and bring the women's character into the foreground. Perspective is the key. External beauty is ephemeral. Internal beauty is eternal. The former is attractive to the world. The latter is pleasing to God. Peter describes the inner beauty as a gentle, a quiet spirit. He paraphrased it, a gentle tranquility. Without question, this is the woman's most powerful quality, true character. And such character comes from within, from the hidden person of the heart. Because you know who you are, and you know who you adore, and serve the Lord Jesus Christ. God just values this kind of inner beauty as imperishable, as precious. And wives that are truly obedient to Christ will find that He will honor their secure spirit. Submission is a mark of security. It's not spineless cringing based on insecurity and fear. It's voluntary unselfishness, a willing and cooperative spirit that seeks the highest good for one's husband. Well, the final verse in this section spotlights on husbands. It's very short, but it's very penetrating. In the same way, you husbands must give honor to your wives. Treat your wife with understanding as you live together. She may be weaker than you are, but she is your equal partner in God's gift of new life. Treat her as you should, so your prayers will not be hindered. As we look at these perspectives, I'm going to again lean heavily on both Chuck Swindoll and Warren Wiersbe from Hope Again and Be Hopeful. First, live with your wife. Now, the Greek term here is composed of soon, with, and okeo, to dwell or abide. And put them together, it obviously means to dwell together. Now, you're probably thinking, well, certainly I live with my wife, I'm married to her. But that's not what Peter's talking about. He is talking about a close togetherness. Soon okeo suggests much more than merely living under the same roof. There is a depth, a sense of intimacy in the word. He's saying that husbands are responsible for that relationship. Providing a good living should never become a substitute for sharing deeply in life. A husband should be home with his wife, understanding every room in his wife's heart, being sensitive to her needs. Dwelling together definitely means more than eating at the same table and sharing the same bed and paying the same mortgage. Second, know your wife. Peter exhorts husbands to live with their wives in an understanding way. And this phrase means according to knowledge, not an academic knowledge, but a thorough understanding of how your wife is put together. Oh, I may know my wife, you say. Brown hair, blue eyes, height, weight, do I dare share? I know what she likes for lunch. Rice cakes covered in peanut butter with coconut oil and raisins. I know where she likes to go for dinner. Her favorite color is purple. Her favorite flower is orchid. Reminds me of a couple that went to a marriage counselor. And when the marriage counselor asked her husband, "What is your wife's favorite flower?" "Pillsbury, I think." It wasn't pretty after that. Your wife is a unique vessel, carefully crafted, beautifully interwoven by her Creator. To know your wife means you know the answers to some of the complex questions about her. What's her innermost makeup? What's her deepest concerns, fears? How do you help her work through them in the safety and security of your love? What does she need from you? Why does she respond as she does? You know, there's no handbook on insights to this. I mean, you can ask the father-in-law, but that's not going to help you. You have to find out in the intimacy of marriage and in the process of cultivating your life together. It takes time. It takes listening. Not only listening, but hearing. It takes paying attention and concentrating and praying for insight, seeking understanding. Most wives long for that. Gloria Perkins, to understand and be understood, to know, really know what another is thinking, to say what you will and be sure it is accepted as of value or sifted through without reproof, to be you, really you, to know that you're loved, really loved. This is near heaven. Few things give a woman more security than knowing her husband really knows her. That's what results in intimacy, and that's what results and turns romance into a deep, lifelong love. That's what keeps her focused and committed to you, longing to have you here, delighting in your presence, in your listening ear. By the way, we need to address another phrase that occurs here in this passage, and that is simply a weaker vessel. Just a word of caution, that has nothing to do with weakness of character or intelligence, and the woman is called the weaker vessel. But that, quote, must not be taken morally, spiritually, or intellectually. It usually means that a woman has less physical strength. The husband recognizes this difference, take it into account. Sometimes that's a bit difficult even to comprehend when we consider what a woman goes through in childbearing. There's no doubt about the kind of strength women have within them when it comes to enduring pain, as like a kidney stone. But when it comes to actual physical strength, Dr. Robert Curlin, who's an orthopedic surgeon and a sports medicine specialist, he says if the sexes had a battle that was to be reduced to a tug of war with a line of 100 men on one side and 100 women on the other over the trench, the men would win. Very simply, it's a difference of muscle makeup. But God's goal for us as husbands is to be sensitive rather than to prove how strong or how macho we are. We need to love our wives, listen to them, adapt to their needs, and third, honor them. To grant her honor is to assign her a place of honor. That same word translated honor in chapter 3, verse 7, refers to the blood of Christ as precious in chapter 1, verse 19. That's a rather significant analogy, I think. Authors Gary Smalley and John Trent define this word well in their book, The Gift of Honor. They write, "In ancient writings, something of honor was something of substance, literally heavy, valuable, costly, even priceless. For Homer, the Greek scholar, The greater the cost of the gift, the more the honor. Not only does it signify something or someone who is priceless treasure, but it is also used for someone who occupies a highly respected position in our lives, someone high on our priority list. That's how husbands are to treat their wives, to honor them by assigning them top priority on their list of human relationships, in their schedules, and most importantly, in their hearts. The journey toward marital maturity is a long one. There's always give and take, changes that always need to be tweaked. Let me summarize what Peter has written. Wives, your actions, your adornments, your attitudes, your attention, they're all critical to a marriage. Husbands, living with your wife, getting to know your wife, honoring your wife, they're imperative if your marriage is going to be what it should be in God's eyes. Marriage is a two-way street. Both sides must need to be maintained. Listen, a good marriage isn't so much finding the right partner as in being the right partner. And that all starts with you. And to seal this heavenly bargain, Peter closes with a promise to both partners so that your prayers may not be hindered. That's an added incentive for husband and wife to live together in domestic harmony, cultivating a close and caring relationship. I quote, "Marriage then functions as a barometer, measuring our spiritual lives through an everyday relationship." Think about it. If Christ is in the midst of two people gathered in his name, just imagine how powerful the prayers of a husband and wife united can be, which more than any human analogy pictures the union of Christ and the church. Ephesians 5, 31 and 32. As the scriptures say, a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. This is a great, a profound mystery, but it's an illustration of the way Christ and the church are one. I close with these words of wisdom to husband and wives that Gary Wheat wrote. View your marriage in a very special way. Look at it as a private little kingdom, a kingdom where you and your partner dwell with the King, Jesus Christ. Private, removed from public view, secluded, not for common use. A special world of belonging, apart from the rush and roar of life all around us, where we can always find renewal and refreshment in each other's love. Selah.